Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review about legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. I'm your host, Drew Padley, editor-in-chief of the Houston Law Review. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 13 offices and more than 750 lawyers committed to excellence in serving its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's summer associate program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins. Today on the show, I have the privilege of interviewing University of Houston Law Center alum and sitting Texas State Representative Armando Wally. Representative Wally grew up in the district that he now represents in the Texas House, a district that encompasses large portions of North Houston. He became a state rep in 2009 when he was only 30 years old. Interestingly enough, it wasn't until he was a sitting state rep that he attended UHLC. Among many other duties, he now sits on the House Appropriations Committee, which means he has a say in how Texas spends its money. There's so much more to say about Representative Wally, but I'll let him tell you instead of me. So without further ado, Representative Wally, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. So just to get started here, could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your circumstances were like?
Sure. This almost sounds like a therapy session, but but truthfully, and you know, just appreciate the invite, you know, particularly from the Law Review. It's obviously a very well-respected publication at the University of Houston Law Center, and obviously being an alumni, it's an honor to be, you know, participate in such a prestigious project or new project. But I grew up in Northeast Houston, off of 59 North and Parker, just east of Parker, off Hirsch and Parker, next to the railroad tracks. My upbringing was a little challenging, if you want to say it that way. My mom had me when she was 16 years old. She was a junior in high school at MacArthur High School, where I actually ended up graduating from as well, in Northeast Houston. And so I'm the oldest of five children. My dad is from Mexico. He immigrated to the United States probably in the mid-70s, met my mother and obviously had me in 1978. And we grew up there in Northeast Houston. And, you know, my very humble beginnings. My mom, I'm very proud of her right now. She never finished high school, but she is actually going to get her GED right now.
That's great.
At one of our local nonprofits. But she never graduated high school. And my dad, you know, came as a teenager, as I mentioned, and worked as a bartender. He worked in construction. But my dad, unfortunately, you know, suffered from a lot of substance abuse issues, and loved my father dearly. But it is a sickness that people suffer from. And so that was the cause of a lot of the issues that he had, that obviously bled into, you know, being a husband and a father. And so he was a positive influence when he was around. But sometimes, you know, he when we were young, I do remember him getting arrested for a DWI. And I've been open about this in the past, so it's not anything that new that I haven't said before. But this is a different setting. But my dad, you know, I remember seeing him at the Harris County Jail when I was in elementary school. I didn't know what was going on. I had an idea. I didn't know at the time. I didn't really know why he got arrested, but I do remember going to visit him down there. You know, I remember my mom always having to deal with that. And so it came to a point where, you know, they were having lots of issues. And, you know, we were on Medicaid, we were on food stamps, we lost our home a couple of times, and we rented a lot. I mean, I moved maybe 8 or 9 times, went to probably 8 or 9 elementary schools. But for the most part, I grew up in Northeast Houston, and my mom had, you know, my other siblings as well. And I was more of a father figure to my younger brothers and sisters, because when my dad actually got put in prison for like 3 years while I was in junior high, I had to make a decision what I wanted to do. And I had a lot of good, positive influences at Hamburg Middle School and MacArthur High School and the Aldine Independent School District. There was a guy named Coach Kelly Silla. He was from Wisconsin, but he got a job as a coach there at Hamburg. And, you know, there's people that come into your lives that, you know, in a positive way. He was that person for me. And I talked to him probably, I still talk to him today.
Oh, yeah.
I talked to him a couple of days ago, actually. We're trying to help a lady, a young lady who fixed her house after Harvey. And so he and I have a great bond, and he was a kind of a positive role model for me. I mean, I can talk about this all the time, but for hours, but it was challenging, right? And so, you know, in high school, I worked at a Mexican restaurant to help my mom pay bills because she was working at Church's Chicken at Airline and Tidwell.
Is that same church is still there?
That church is still there. It's right at the corner. And so there were times when that's all we would eat is those drumsticks and those biscuits, right? Because my mom, only, at the time, I think minimum wage was like $4.35 an hour. You know, trying to raise 4 or 5 kids off of that, that's not going to happen. And so, you know, I went to work myself. And this is, again, you know, my dad was gone. My mom's trying to, you know, put food on the table, literally put food on the table. She didn't have a high school diploma. She didn't have any training, formal training, education-wise. So those are the job. That's the job she could get at the time. She ended up getting a job later on at a candle factory. That company went bankrupt. So when she actually finally bought a house, you know, she had worked there probably 10 years. She had to get foreclosed on it because she lost her job. So right when she was kind of, you know, getting on some equal footing, you know, she went bankrupt, or the company went bankrupt, and she got her house foreclosed on. The first house she ever bought. And so there had been a lot of ups and downs, right? But through it all, I've always tried to have a positive outlook on life. And, you know, my faith, I don't wear my faith on my sleeve, but it's a big part of who I am. My grandparents were very influential in my life. I lived with them for number of years. And my grandfather was a union steel worker in the 70s and 80s. And then when the oil bust happened in 83, he worked at Hughes Tools here, which was kind of like the former, or the, it evolved into KBR, Halliburton. Now I think it's now KBR, back to KBR or something like that. But he had a welding shop next to the house. And so I would help him, you know, with the burglar bar fence company that he had. I was his post hole digger, right? So we built fences. So, I mean, I know I'm a little rambling on, but that's, you know, gives you a little sense of kind of my upbringing. There were challenges economically. I mean, there was no doubt. I knew we were, I guess, there's no other term to call it, but I knew we were poor. And so that was, you know, I had a lot of positive, I mean, through all the challenges, I mean, I can go for days to talk about some of the things that happened in my life, but through all those challenges, I was been very blessed to have positive people in my life that steered me right. Because don't get me wrong, I made mistakes. I grew up in a rough neighborhood. I still live about 2 miles from the area, from the neighborhood I grew up in. I represent it in the legislature now, but I know the challenges that my constituents face on a daily basis because I live them. But for the most part, I've been very fortunate as well to take advantage of the opportunities that I've been afforded, you know, going to University of Houston or attending University of Houston and earning a bachelor's degree, attending law school late in life. So that's kind of my upbringing. It was a little rough, but overall, always had a lot of faith.
It sounds like, you know, there were some hard times, but you have a really nice support structure that kind of helped you out and gave you some good advice at different times and all
that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of teachers, a lot
takes
of counselors.
Takes a village, huh?
Absolutely. Took a village to raise me because there were some times, you know, you in our neighborhood, you know, there's knuckleheads, right?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And it would have been real easy to go down that path, right? Because I had friends that I grew up with that ended up in prison. I had friends that ended up getting shot and killed because of the gang violence in the neighborhood. But I will say this, the people in our neighborhood, they're good, hardworking people. You know, yes, we have challenges. Yes, we have knuckleheads. But you know what? There are knuckleheads everywhere. That's right. They're in every walk of life. They're in every neighborhood. Our side of town, right? You know, I guess it's unfortunate that if it has a negative, for some has a negative, some people have a negative view of it. I love my part of town. I love the people because, you know, they're the ones who helped raise me, you know? If it wasn't for that neighborhood, I wouldn't be here. If it weren't for the people that, you know, influenced me on what to do and what not to do, right? I wouldn't be here. So I love my neighborhood. I love the people that I grew up with. Yeah, people make mistakes, but there's something called redemption, right? So for others, my side of town, you know, they crack jokes about it, right? And we can have fun about it, but, you know, I'm very protective of the people that I grew up with and the area that I grew up with, that I grew up in, because those are hardworking people just like anybody else. It's an area that has a lot of pride, and like a lot of other neighborhoods, when somebody talks bad about your part of town, you take that personal, right? And so it was rough. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, for me, I love being able to, you know, say I'm from there, say I represent there now in the legislature.
Yeah, I mean, through and through, you know, born there, stayed there.
Stay there, yeah.
And then now you represent.
I now represent
elsewhere for that neighborhood.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
A beautiful story.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, let's back up a little bit to your time at University of Houston. So you went there for college to mm-hmm. begin with. And I think I read that you were the first in your family to attend college. So I know that comes with its own unique challenges as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was the first to graduate high school. And, you know, out of all my cousins, all my uncles, my mom didn't graduate. My dad, you know, kind of a weird situation. He got his GED while he was in prison. But I was the first to graduate from high school. And so my mom made a big party for me. And I was embarrassed about it because I knew my mom couldn't really afford it, but she wanted to throw me a party. She bought me a class ring and stuff like that. So it was a big deal for us. And attended the University of Houston the fall of 1997. And I was a work study. And I got involved on campus. And, well, let me backtrack, right? Because this is very related. I didn't know what a FAFSA was, right? I didn't know how to fill out a college application. But I had a 10th grade English teacher. Her name is Ms. Bailey. She had made a package for me. She goes, look, in these folders, I want you to put your college applications, okay? And I'm going to write down, and you're going to have one for each college. Two, you're going to have one for your FAFSA. And I didn't know what a FAFSA was, right? Because back then, you used to do it by paper. Now it's electronic. Three, we're going to put a little sheet for you that gives you all the deadlines, right? And so four, your personal statement, right? Because you have to, I guess, do a personal statement or write something to these schools why you should go, you know, why they should let you in. And then I had my SAT score. Scores, like I had copies of them. And then she organized me into, you know, knowing what to do. She goes, no, this is how you do it. I was like, okay. So I just followed her instructions. And U of H was the school that accepted me. My dream was to go away to college. That was kind of what I wanted to do. And I wanted to play football. But I still felt the tug to stay home because of my mom, you know, was still by herself. And my brothers and sisters were very young. And so I stayed home at the University of Houston. It was, for me, it ended up working out, right? I didn't live on campus, but it was a great experience because I got to learn about a whole bunch of new people, right, once I got to UH. It's a very diverse campus. And it had a lot of Hispanic kids too, right? So that was important. And so I got involved with the Center for Mexican American Studies. I worked there as helping recruit other Hispanic kids to come to U of H from other high schools. So once we were kind of like mentors, college mentors to the high school kids. And so I was really heavily involved on student in the Hispanic Student Association and got really involved in on campus. So much so that I got this internship with the Texas Legislative Internship Program. A friend of mine, who's a current member of the legislature, her name is Ana Hernandez, she encouraged me to do the program, and I really wasn't wanting to do it because I wasn't really political. I was always involved on other things like community service projects. And on campus, we were like the first group that sold fajita tacos there at the PGH Breezeway for we were raising money to buy Christmas toys for needy kids. And so we were hustling tacos. So I was just always on campus. I stayed there all the time just because it was more of a positive influence. And again, it was eye-opening experience, right? Because it's the first time I got a C as well. high school does, you know, I thought I got a good, you know, baseline education in Aldine. What I failed to do was figure out, you pick your own classes? Ah, okay. I shouldn't pick that 7 a.m. class, right? And you have a good time, have too much of a good time. And you know, your academics sometimes fall to the wayside, but I was working a lot too. I was working on campus. I was a work study, and I worked two jobs and working as a waiter at a Mexican restaurant. And so, sometimes my studies, you know, would kind of lag as well. Right. There was just not enough time in the day to get the studying in. But, you know, I made the grade to kind of keep going. And it took me a while. It took me 7 years to finish my undergrad. So it was challenging. Again, these are ups and downs. Right?
The scenic route you took.
Yeah, took a very scenic route.
So tell me about that internship that you said you got with the Texas legislature.
So I did the Texas Legislative Internship Program, and it was a program sponsored through Senator Rodney Ellis, who's now County Commissioner for Precinct 1. And he called me, actually. I'd never had an elected official call me or, you know, have any interest in me, but called me and said, hey, I see your resume. I see your application. You know, I see that some of your grades are a little, you know, could need improvement, but I see a lot of myself in you, right? I want to give you a chance. And so, you know, I said, thank you, Senator. I won't let you down. I'll, you know, work my butt off. I work my butt off. I'm a hustler, right? And so he selected me. I was the last person to be selected, but it was in the year 2000. Well, the legislature meets every odd number year. And so he says, hey, you can wait till 2001. Or you can do it now. I decided to do it now, to do it then in 2000. And so what he did is he put us in local council member offices. So he put me at the City Hall with Carol Mims Galloway, who was a first term member of City Council. And she represented Acres Homes, Cashmere Gardens, Fifth Ward, Scenic Woods, Pleasantville. These are, you know, and kind of northeast Houston. And so it's a majority minority district, majority African-American with a good chunk of Hispanic. But for the most part, it was a predominantly African-American district. It was District B. Had historic neighborhoods, obviously, Fifth Ward, Cashmere Gardens, African-American neighborhoods. And so it was a wonderful experience. And it was a great experience because it kind of puts you out of your comfort zone, right? So I guess it would have been easy for him to put me in another Hispanic elected official's office, but he put me in a first-term African-American council member, and it was a great experience. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I find building relationships with different communities and learning about the ins and outs and being able to extend a hand where you can and then learn and pick up things where you can as well, it's always beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't burn any bridges either, right? And so it was a wonderful experience, even though, you know, it's a different community, right? Just like any other community is different. I think we all want the same things, mm-hmm. right? You all want a, you know, safe neighborhood, send your kids to a good schools, and you know, have an opportunity for a job and provide for your families. I mean, I think that's a universal. It doesn't matter where you come from, but it was an eye-opening experience to go to an African-American, predominantly African-American church, and get up and speak on behalf of your boss. And so it's at the same time frightening, but also exhilarating. Yeah.
And so that's your first brush with a sort of public life as well, in terms of public administration, I guess, councilwoman.
Yes. It was my first time doing any kind of politics.
And so did you, the second you tasted it, you knew you wanted it? Or was it sort of like, well, this is an interesting thing and I like the work that's being done here?
I think it evolved into into this is something I like doing. It wasn't right away, because I didn't know what to expect. But as I mentioned, I was always a hustler. I was always... You know, the council member said, hey, I need you to go to a civic club tonight. I'll be there, right? Hey, I need you to staff this committee meeting. I'll be there. Hey, you need to answer the phones. You need to be, we want you to, I was an intern, so I was going to answer phones. But answering the phones, over the weeks, you were fielding calls on people's issues in their neighborhoods, right? So it'd be, hey, my trash hasn't been picked up, or hey, I need this pothole to be fixed. Hey, the sewer line backed up, right? Those are like neighborhood issues that to somebody it's not important, but to that person that picks up the phone to call their elected official, they want government to work for them, right? And so it evolved over time. I was like, hey, and you're the intern, you're doing all that grunt work, right? You're calling Public Works, you're calling HPD, you're calling the Houston Fire Department, you're calling Solid Waste, you're calling Houston Parks Department because of the playground equipment is, corroded, right? Neighborhoods want new playground equipment, better parks. So you're taking those calls, and over time, you're like, I think I can do this, right? Maybe not as an elected official, right, but as a staffer. And so I worked as a staffer for that semester. Ended up landing a job at Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee's office, who repped a lot of the same area. So I was familiar, did a lot of outreach for her, did a lot of special projects, and then ultimately worked for Congressman Gene Green. And that's where I really, I guess, grew professionally.
And now where you grew up and is in Congressman Gene's district?
Yes, Gene Green, yeah. So it was kind of a homecoming, right? Because I worked for about a year with Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, but Congressman Green was, who's also a University of Houston Law Center alumni.
Oh, really? Okay.
He
might have to add him to the list.
Yeah, you will. So I worked for him for about 8 years. And so that's really where it took off, is I understood how to pull the levers of government, right? Meaning when a constituent called, you had to call the right agency. You had to help them navigate that process, right? And so I understood what was going on, right? And I understood that budgets and revenue is really very important to governments, right? But, spending those resources wisely, too. But at the city level, most of your budget is public safety, police and fire, and public works, but particularly public safety. Police and fire are your biggest drivers of your local budgets. And so I understood that. And then when I got to work for Congress, and Congress is a whole other animal. And the policies, very different. You're at a national level. I think I started working for Gene Green around 2001. And the first project I worked on with him was Tropical Storm Allison. that storm hit Houston in 2001. And obviously, unfortunately, you know, 9/11, I was a staffer there at the time, and it was a very difficult time. But, you know, I understood what was going on. I had an idea. I didn't understand completely, but I had an idea what was going on. And being able to help people, particularly when Tropical Storm Allison hit, and how FEMA, how the federal role, state role, and your local role, you know, kind of, you have to work together. And those experiences as a staffer helped me as a legislator.
So did you ever go out to Washington, D.C. while you were working for Congressman?
I did. Green? I did some trainings up there. The first time I ever went to D.C. was when I was an adult working for Congressman Green. He's a great boss. They both were great. Carol Mims Galloway, Sheila Jackson Lee, and particularly Gene Green. I spent most of my professional political life with Gene Green. You know, he's a great boss and really took care of us, mentored us. And he worked really hard, right? And he was an interesting guy because he's Anglo guy, but grew up in the neighborhood close to where I grew up, represented majority minority district, right? So the dynamics were very interesting. But you know, he's from our side of town too. So
yeah, sure.
He's one of us, you know, and from our neighborhood. And so I learned a lot from him, and he was a great boss.
So is it true that he encouraged you to go to law school as well?
They did. Him and Senator Ellis and others, you know, they were, and Senator Whitmire, they're always on me to go to law school because I got elected first before I got elected before I went to law school. So it was, those years were very just crazy.
I can imagine, yeah.
Because I just recently got married in 2007, and we recently bought a house, and I decided to go run for the legislature. And so I quit my job in Congressman Green's office to run for the legislature, and I'm not independently wealthy. I wasn't retired, wasn't in a lawyer, wasn't in the oil and gas business, wasn't a rancher, you know. And so, you know, the legislature is considered a citizen legislature, but if you're not independently wealthy or have the means to do it, it's very hard to do that because there's no job that will keep you on the payroll and then 6 months out of the year, every other year, take a 6 month hiatus and say, hey, I got to leave, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up was applying to law school anyway, but so happened that I got... I got elected first.
You had a backup plan.
I had a backup plan. So I got elected in 2008. I got sworn in 2009. By the fall of 2009, I was a student at the University of Houston Law Center.
So you started as a student just after the legislative session had passed. So you had a little bit of time before you had to go to Austin.
Okay. I had a summer.
Oh, just this summer.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was in Austin because you have to kind of go to Austin, live there. And I was commuting back and forth on the weekends because I just got married. So mm-hmm. It was
in that new house.
In the new house.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was challenging. But you know, my wife has been great. She's been with me through all of this, you know, my six terms in the legislature right now. But at the time it was, you know, there were times when she was the primary breadwinner and, so I owe a lot to her, and she helped me she put me through law school as well. So
this is the wife and husband appreciation moment.
Oh, so, yes.
Yeah.
And today's her birthday. So
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Happy birthday, Mrs.
Miss
Wally.
Debbie.
Mrs. Debbie.
Debbie Wally.
All right. And let me see. So, yeah, actually, your election to the Texas House, I think you took on an 18-year incumbent.
I did.
Is that right?
I did.
And so what sort of made you think that that was the right move and that maybe you could win?
Well, it's kind of it's a crazy move, right? Because 90%+ of incumbents win. And in our districts, you know, unfortunately, our district is one of the lowest voting participating districts in the whole state. And so the previous primaries that he had, my opponent at the time, Representative Bailey, he had won with like 1,200 votes, right? And so each of those districts at the time were about 140, 150,000. Now they're about 170. And after the next census, they're going to want them. The ideal district is going to be like pushing 190, 190,000 residents. And so very low turnout. But, you know, a lot of things is timing. And so there was obviously going to be a presidential election primary. And this was before the party apparatus in the state was, you had this Texas two-step deal where you, you know, had to caucus for the primaries after you actually went to go vote. So you'd go vote in the primary and then you had the caucus. Well, we knew there was going to be a lot of anticipation, a lot of participation because you had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama still running a very vigorous campaign. And we knew turnout was going to be high. And as I mentioned, I've always been a hustler. And so I started walking my district. I walked to my district probably three or four times myself. And so I knocked on doors. I wore out, you know, shoe leather, and had a lot of support from friends and family. I grew up there, went to church there. My wife grew up there. I was confident we were going to win, not cocky in that sense, but I was confident because I knew I would outwork Representative Bailey. And he was a good guy, just kind of, had been there 18 years, right? And maybe he got complacent, right? But you know, he's not a bad guy. I mean, I don't have any ill will towards him at all. I don't hold any ill will towards him at all. I just felt that at the time the district needed more energy, needed more participation. And so I ran, and my parents, my whole family, they were there volunteering at the campaign office, doing phone banking, block walking, knocking on doors. And so it was great. It was a great experience. I highly recommend it.
If anybody has some extra time on their hands, yes, Now you know what to do. All right. So you made it to the Texas House. Congratulations.
Thank
on
you.
Your victory. And I thought it was a pretty cool story. I mean, there's this famous Houston Chronicle article that talks about your first few days out in the Capitol.
Yes.
And you know, the story about all your family coming in on the bus, and you know, they all wanted to be there for the big day. It sounded like, you know, they all contributed pretty heavily to
They were invested.
Yeah. And then, you know, I'm sure you settled in over the next couple of years into the House. So,
well, look, let me backtrack. I was very happy to see my grandparents, you know, see me sworn in. My grandmother has since passed, but she did get to see me, you know, sworn into the legislature, you know, somebody that, you know, picked onions in Uvalde County, somebody that cleaned houses when she got to Houston in the, you know, 50s or early, late 50s, mid early 60s, I'm sorry. And my grandfather's steel worker, you know, it was a very huge sense of pride for them. And I was so glad to make them proud that, you know, we got there, right? And we achieved this, you know, this position of public trust, right? And authority as well. So when we got to the legislature, some of the things that I, you know, wanted to make a priority was early on, you're told, you know, don't make a lot of fuss, you know, keep your nose to the grind, don't talk a lot. Some of my earliest legislative accomplishments were more so, I had a set of goals or policy positions that I wanted to tackle. Obviously, education was one, healthcare was another. But working with youth, because, you know, having grown up the way I grew up, I wanted to focus on young people. And so, like, the first bill that I actually filed was a graffiti bill. And what we did is we changed the penal code to allow, and it was very simple. It wasn't like, you know, earth shattering, but What we did early on was we changed the penal code. So young people that were, and the juvenile code, I'm sorry, that were caught tagging or, you know, doing some type of graffiti and damaging property, that we would allow community service and or tutoring to qualify as along with restitution. But in lieu of going to jail, let the kid go tutoring or do some community service, right? Along with the restitution. And so it was a very small bill that we passed, but it caused a lot of commotion because there was a lot of amendments that people wanted to add on to it. And
did they want to add the amendments on to tank it, or did they?
They wanted to add the amendments to make it harsher, like state jail felony, and also take away somebody's driver's license. And so, which was totally opposite of what I wanted to do. Right, I wanted to, you know, still hold young people accountable, but do it in a reasonable way.
Yeah, right? not in a incarceration focus.
We already had too many people in jail, right? Yeah. Particularly, we were trying to, you know, decriminalize. I mean, I don't say decriminalize, but minimize some of the harshness of some of the what's in the penal code as it relates to juveniles, right? And so that was one of the bills that we passed. A signature bill, I would say, was the passage of the Texas Maternal Mortality Review Board. We had some local health officials from Harris Health come to us and say, hey, we've seen a lot of spike in deaths of mothers, you know, post-birth. And so, you know, we want to know if you're interested in, you know, maybe taking up this issue. And I was like, well, why me? They're like, no, I mean, we think you know, you can carry this bill. And mind you, I didn't really know much about it, right? But as staff and myself started reading up on it and doing a lot of research, we're like, wow, this is a problem. And in 2011, we filed an infant mortality review board, and we filed a maternal mortality and morbidity task force to study statewide why women were dying at a higher rate, but particularly why African-American women were dying at a higher rate than the national average. This was before it became a big issue.
You now see presidential candidates talking about it. It's right? Much more in the public discourse.
It's more plugged into public discourse. Well, we were doing that in 2011. And it was a bipartisan bill. Me and Joan Huffman, Senator Huffman, passed that bill because it didn't pass in 2011. We had to file it again in 2013 because it didn't get out of the House or didn't get out of the Senate. But we got it done in 2013, and Dr. Ollier, who is with Baylor, I think she was with ACOG. She's a American College of Obstetricians. Obstetrics and gynecology. Yeah. ACOG. And so she was very involved in ACOG, and we got a lot of support for it, got a lot of bipartisan support, and it got done. Well, lo and behold, they started doing their report, and boom, we basically got a confirmation from our local health officials what was happening and what was happening statewide and what was happening in certain zip codes of the state of Texas where, you know, women were dying at a higher rate, but particularly African-American women. And so they've issued several reports since then. And then, you know, years, you know, I guess 2015, 2017-ish around there, boom, it becomes a big deal. Statewide, then you had, you know, ProPublica had a report. New York Times. Every publication was writing about this. And so I think that... you know, I it certainly wasn't just me, right? It was a lot of advocates, but policy-wise, Senator Huffman and I are the ones that passed the first, you know, bill to try to get a handle of what was going on. So I think that's it's a legislative accomplishment over the years. Serving on the Appropriations Committee, being able to steer resources has been, I think, a legislative accomplishment. So let me backtrack. So when you're an elected official, you definitely if you want to accomplish anything, you have to have high expectations, right? And so we all want to pass monumental legislation that helps folks, right? But in the meantime, while you're learning, right, and learning your chops and learning that you can do this and showing to the powers that be that, you know, you're somebody to be taken serious, and we do our homework and we do our research and we're you know, heavy lifters and we want to, you know, pass bills. The job also entails helping folks back home, right? So the job is, yes, to pass legislation, but also to advocate, to speak out on certain issues, right? And be that voice for your constituents. One of the non-legislative victories that we had was we didn't really have a lot of nonprofits. We had one, which is Aldine Youth, which is a community center down where I grew up. Ms. Sylvia Bowling is a great lady. Her and her family run a great, you know, nonprofit there. But we needed more help, right? And so my first term in office, I reached out to a big nonprofit at the time. It's called Neighborhood Centers, Inc. It's now turned to Baker Ripley. They're a huge nonprofit. They run these community centers all over the city. Gulfton is one. Ripley House is another. They have one in Pasadena. And so I reached out to them. And I requested a meeting from the CEO, and I said, hey, and I brought census tracts, and I brought a map, huge maps of my district in North Houston. And I laid out the map, said, hey, you know, y'all do great work. Y'all do a lot of youth involvement programs. Y'all do a lot of senior citizen programs, a lot of after school programs. Can y'all do something like that in our area? In our part of town, which is unincorporated. And I showed her, I was like, hey, these are some of the agencies that are around us. We don't have anything out here for youth to go hang out, right? Initially, she heard me out. She was very positive about it. But she's like, "That, you know, we're not ready to branch out right now." They had just finished building Gulfton. And I would recommend folks to go out there and see it. because they do a lot of immigration work as well, a lot of refugee work.
I know that it's a popular destination for students at the University of Houston Law Center who want to do immigration work.
I did the clinic.
Oh, you did the clinic?
I did the clinic. Yeah. And so actually, Jill Campbell used to be my professor.
Mm-hmm. She's at Baker Ripley now.
She's the director of the immigration services at Baker Ripley. So yeah, I know her very well. And so that, see, it was like relationships like that, people that come into your life like that, that mm-hmm. leave lasting impact. And so I said, hey, at the time, the new, or I won't say new, but the current CEO is Claudia Vasquez. But the previous CEO, her name was Angela Blanchard. And her and I established a very good relationship. And I said, hey, look, we don't have anything out here. We need you to come out here. She's like, well, you know, we're not ready to go out there, yada, yada, yada. And I was like, okay. So I kept writing her. And I kept bugging her. And, you know, over the years, they said, hey, you know, we might go out there. Well, we have these special purpose districts that are set up by the legislature. They're called management districts, and they're taxing entities, right? They're quasi-governmental. And in our part of town, we have one called the East Aldine Management District, and we assess a one-penny sales tax in that geographic area to do economic development, kind of like a TERS, a tax increment reinvestment zone. It's kind of like that. Similar concepts, but this one's more broad because we have people out there that don't have sewer and water connections. So we've been able to use those resources, the management district resources, to get people onto basic city water, wastewater services, or municipal services. The other component was they wanted to, with their revenue streams, they wanted to buy property and develop it for public use. They bought 60 acres, and they invested the infrastructure, the water, and all the stuff you needed to develop the property. I reached out to David Halls, who's the runs the management districts. And I said, hey, David, called him on the phone. I said, hey, we got this nonprofit. I know you guys want to build something out there too in the future, but why do we have to reinvent the wheel? Why don't we allow Baker Ripley partner with them, you know, offer them a piece of the property at a low to no cost, and they can build a community center on it. They said, oh, that might be a good idea. Called Angela Blanchard up and said, hey, okay, I know y'all might be considering coming out here, but what if the land wasn't an issue? She goes, well, mate, you know, that's now you're changing the dynamics. And we got them on a conference call, those two on the David Halls and Angela Blanchard on the conference call, and said, hey, why can't we make this happen? They're like, yeah, you know, sounds like a plan. And so they signed an MOU mm-hmm. to begin the process of doing that, right? And so what dovetailed into, so that starts to happen. And so Baker Ripley at their annual luncheon says they're going to have a capital campaign. They make the announcement that they're going to come out to Aldine. I was ecstatic, right? Because that's official. So they had two people co-chair the fundraising, the capital campaign for this project. And they built a $20 million community center. Right down the street from where I grew up.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so what ended up happening is Lone Star College, the college, community college district out here, we kind of had to bust some knees, you know, to let, and Dr. Head's a great guy. I say that, you know, fondly of him. But Dr. Head, we convinced him to build a satellite college campus right next to the Baker Ripley. So then Aldine Independent School District said, hey, we just passed a bond. You know, let's try to see if we can do an early college high school. So they built an early college high school along with the community college in the same building with walking trails and a fountain, a beautiful fountain. And then Harris County 911 Center moved their operations to the back, the rear part of the property. Then we're in talks with the management district's going to build a public safety building now. And we're in kind of negotiations with HEB to maybe bring a grocery chain or some kind of grocery chain out there, because we had Kroger that closed down the road from the from this property. And so we're looking for a partner, grocery chain partner. And so it's a $100 million investment in our community that again, it's not a legislative per se way, but you have to find other ways to impact your community, right? Obviously, you got to go to Austin and pass bills. That's, you know, you got
to
do that.
But there's so much more to representing than just the legislation.
Than just the legislature. Now, the legislature is big, right? Because let me go back. So now the state, I'm on the Appropriations Committee, was able to help pass the budget, and let alone that, be on the Conference Committee. And so what that means is there's 150 members of the legislature, of the House, 31 in the Senate. Only 10 people get to hash out that budget. Five conferees, what they call conferees from the Senate, who serve on the Finance Committee on that version. And then 27 members of the House Appropriations Committee, only five of those members actually get to be selected by the Speaker to serve on the Conference Committee to hash out, to basically negotiate the House version and the Senate version so that we pass, obviously, the same bill. And so being able to have the influence on, as a conferee, to steer resources to hurricane recovery, to after school programs here locally, or actually statewide. We invested money in communities and schools. We invested money in paying our teachers, giving teacher raises, 13 check for retired teachers. The disaster recovery was a whole big, another animal that I was involved in those negotiations as well. Again, there's stuff that doesn't necessarily have my name on it, but we had a huge influence in where those resources were going to be steered. Obviously, the University of Houston Law Center is one. We were able to obtain, at our request, $45 million, but they had to share it, $45 million with the University of Houston Law Center for a new building, and also for the Hobby School for public affairs there on campus. And so directly was very helpful that I graduated from the University of Houston Law Center. Owe a lot to the university. So it's just only fitting that when I reached a position of authority. And you know, mind you, this is, it's a $250 billion budget. And only 10 people are actually, and in the governor's office, obviously, as well, are hashing the budget out, the fine tune, you know, of hashing this budget out. We're the 10th largest economy in the world. I mean, it's a huge responsibility. And I think, again, we've had a lot of legislative victories along the way, local water issues in our community for them, more training for school resource officers. We passed a bill that we joint authored with Helen Giddings at the time to do more training for what they call school resource officers. Those are your ISDPDs, that the police officers that are in schools to, you know, learn about de-escalation techniques, right? Because we were having a whole bunch of kids that were, you know, being over-criminalized. And so, I mean, I can name a whole bunch of other issues that we've worked on, but here recently, the budget has been one that we've been very, and disaster recovery has been one that we've been very active and influential on that role.
Well, all of those are very important initiatives, but the building thing also, you know, it's come up in every interview I've done so far. So I can say definitely thank you on behalf of all of us who are working in that concrete basement and sitting in the same chairs that people did 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, we really appreciate that. And not to take anything away from the other accomplishments and initiatives, but that one's particularly relevant to our law school.
Certainly. Yeah, no, we want to thank obviously Dr. Couture and mm-hmm. Dean Baines and the alumni groups that have contributed, the O'Quinn Foundation, all of our alumni that have, you know, put money. They know as you say firsthand, the need for it's a top rate, top 50 law school in the country, one of the best law schools in the country. It deserves, you know, the best facilities. Obviously, Philip, you know, just because you have a new building that make you a better automatically, but I think the people are there already to make it better.
I think the perception will change very quickly.
But
you're right, I don't think it changes the quality of the education. It's already very high.
It's already high,
but it shines a little light on it.
It does add that little cherry on top for us. It's a huge cherry, actually. but you know, I want to thank all the university alumni that have contributed, because they've put, you know, resources into it. And luckily, I was there at, as I mentioned earlier in the earlier part of the interview, timing, you know, the timing was almost perfect, that I'd be on the conference committee negotiating the budget and slipping, you know, these $45 million. I actually requested 60.
Oh yeah.
They gave me 45.
Yeah. Next time we'll request, you know, 120.
That's right.
They give all right. So yeah, I think that's a great description of some of the things that you've done in the legislature so far. Do you think that anything should be different about our state legislative session? Are you comfortable with it meeting, you know, once every 2 years? Do you think that $7,000 is a good salary? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I'm not independently wealthy, so it is a challenge, right? So I think that we're the largest state that still has a part-time legislature, right? California doesn't have their full-time legislature. New York, full-time. I mean, there's no reason. I mean, the brevity in the amount of days. So we meet for 140 days every odd number year, but we can't do any of the state's business until after the 60th day. So it really, in a condensed amount of time, we do have interim hearings, what they call when we're not in session. We do have budget hearings. We have legislative budget board. That's kind of like the Office of OM, Office of Budget and Management at the federal level. The LBB is a similar agency that meet. But by and large, as I mentioned before, we passed a $250 billion budget, right? That's a two-year budget. So I think that there are so many examples making the case that we need to meet at least for the budget every year for maybe 60 days, like maybe have a 60-day budget process in the interim. So I'm gonna give you one example. One example was, two examples. One was Harvey, right? We had to make state expenditures to be able to respond to Harvey. And we were calling on the governor to call a special session, right? Because the governor is the only person that can call us back to Austin when we're not in session for whatever reason. And we've done that before. It's not unprecedented. And so on other issues that really, like on bathrooms a couple of sessions ago. I mean, just...
Nothing like compared to nothing know, the compared devastation to of Harvey.
The is $150 billion estimate damage to the state of Texas. Homes, property, you also had the loss of life, somebody's livelihood, you know, we're trying to recover. And so some of us were calling for the governor to call us back, right? If it was in a normal budget process, boom, you can make, you know, you would get bipartisan support, overwhelming support. I would say you would get overwhelming support to make those immediate expenditures. Now, the governor was able to move money around, do budget execution, what they call budget execution, and able to move money around, basically, and ask folks to trim their budget so that we can pay for these expenditures, you know. But again, that's one example. Another example was CPS, and you had children dying under the care of the Child Protective Services, right? You have lawsuits being filed, and you have a current one for the foster care system. I believe that those are emergency situations, right? Where if we were in a normal budget, yearly budget process, we can make those expenditures right away and not wait to the next session to make expenditures again, right? Because now again, the governor did some budget execution to give CPS caseworkers a $1,000 check bonus, right? But it shouldn't have to come to that, right? Because aside from the resources, we also need to have the policy that follows it. And or the policy and the money flows through that policy, right? So again, this is a huge state, huge responsibilities, let alone education and healthcare, which are our biggest budget drivers. School districts need to know how to budget correctly, right? So if they're right now, ISDs, independent school districts, one of our largest expenditures, they're passing a budget when we're not in session, right? So when they're passing budgets, we've already passed our budget. So they're having to wait to get almost reimbursed for the expenditures that they're making, right? It just, the timing of it just doesn't function. Another example, Health and Human Services. So for Medicaid, we get reimbursed. It's a federal share, state, federal match. We get reimbursed, or we for some communities, so for right now, the five largest hospital districts, county hospital districts in the state of Texas, they're called intergovernmental transfers. What we do is they front the money to be able to draw down federal money, okay? And that's, again, where it meets your local governments, right? Because I'm talking about the Harris County Hospital District. Well, now it's called Harris Health. But again, being able to match the resources with the dates and making it hard for governmental agencies to be able to budget on a two-year cycle versus a yearly cycle, and one that follows kind of almost, not exactly, but kind of follows their budget process. I think it makes it easier on local governments, on state governments, on independent school districts, right? So I think that's a long answer for, you know, having a full-time legislature.
All right. So I also read an article that you briefly considered running for United States Congress in Representative Congressman Green's old spot. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was about a 2 or 3 day
yeah.
consideration. Being a young father of young kids, my family is very, very important to me. And as I mentioned about my early on in my personal life and having my dad in and out of our lives, and I want to be much more involved, much more personally involved with my kids. And I spend a lot of time, you know, helping coach the baseball team, and my boys both play baseball. I'm highly involved in their school. You know, I like to read to them at night. You know, I like to do help with their homework, you know, when they get off of school. I drop them off in the morning at school. I try to, you know, be like any other dad, you know, and I think the quality of that time would be diminished if I, you know, won a seat to Congress. So, you know, it was cool while it lasted, right?
Yeah, sure.
But reality just sets in and you're like, you know what? Right now in my position, being a senior member of the legislature now, I'm going to file for my seventh term. I've been doing this, you know, roughly 11, 12 years now. And the political winds are changing as well. You know, Democrats are making a strong comeback. And if we win control of the House, the legislature, I think I stand to be in a good position to be an influential, much more of an influential member of the legislature. And so right now, the best days for me, I think, are in the Texas House right now.
Yeah, those sound like great reasons. all right, I don't want to hold you for too long, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about your law practice. So at this point, are you a solo practitioner?
I'm a solo practitioner. I have the law office of Armando Wally. And
it's got a nice ring to it.
Yes. This has been one hell of a ride. I did work for a personal injury firm for about 4 or 5 years in law school. While I was in law school, it took me a while to finish law school too. And had academic challenges in law school and with the bar, but overcame all those challenges and got my license in 2017, opened up my practice. I got my license in December 2017. I opened up the law office of Armando Wally in January of 2018.
Oh, wow.
But I do mostly court appointments on the family and the civil side. So I'm a guardian ad litem on some civil cases. I'm an amicus on divorce cases. I've started to do some child support enforcements, done a couple of divorces, done a couple of trust and wills. Right now, just kind of jack of all trades, but probably the majority of my practice now is court appointments. I spend a lot of time at the courthouse and picking up some CPS cases. And so most of my practice pretty much deals with advocating for children. And it's been great. But it does allow me flexibility, right? So, my days sometimes are very, can be pretty hectic. So some days I can have 2 or 3 hearings at the courthouse in the morning, have a 11, 12 o'clock meeting with constituents, or have an event back in my district, to go, you know, complete my legislative responsibilities, then maybe come back to the law office, to do some more law, legal work, go pick up my kids from school or from tutoring, get home and do some more law work, or be on the phone at night, you know, because people call me, they have my cell now, I'm pretty accessible. They'll call me, you know, 7, 8 o'clock at night saying, hey, can you help us with, you know, with, there's a family that needs help. Can you bring some resources out here? So that's kind of how my days go. But as a law practice, that's a majority of my work is court appointments right now. I mean, being a young lawyer, it helps, right, to get those appointments, because the anxiety and the courtroom, you know, that type of practice is not for everybody, right? Everybody that gets a law degree, they may or may not practice. And even if you do practice per se, that practice may never bring you into the courtroom.
The last podcast I recorded was with Judge King on the Fifth Circuit, and she said that she had never seen the inside of a courtroom until she was appointed to be a judge on the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah, I mean, it's the law degree is you know, and particularly the one that obviously you will have soon, and that we hold is it's a big deal. I mean, it comes with some sets of responsibilities. Obviously, you have an oath to uphold the Constitution, the state Constitution. You have to be ethical. You have to take care of your business, you know, that way as well, and be a good lawyer, be a fierce advocate for your clients. But a lot of times, some lawyers, they don't practice per se in the courtroom. They're general counsels here, or they work for a nonprofit, or they work for government entities, right? For me, the law degree has been invaluable. I just so happen to use it in a practical setting. I joke with people, I'm just a small town lawyer from Aldean, Houston, Texas.
All right, well, Representative Wiley, I think you are smart, tough, compassionate, great state legislator. Really happy for the work that you've been doing for your district and for Texas as a whole. So on behalf of the Houston Law Review, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck to you in the future.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and go Cougs.
Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association and from Vincent and Elkins. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email me at eic@houstonlawreview.org. Be sure to follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at HoustonLRev. That's Houston, L-R-E-V. Or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.